future and call 1-800-686-2237.
Black Berkey purification elements are more powerful than any gravity filter element on the market. These awesome elements are used in Berkey purification systems, and they can also be used to upgrade most other gravity filtration systems. They can purify raw, untreated water by removing pathogenic bacteria, cysts, parasites, trihalomethanes, and chemicals such as chlorine, atrazine, styrene, and MTBE. These elements also reduce unwanted heavy metals such as lead, mercury, and aluminum. Unbelievably, they even remove small microparticulate from water like food coloring particles. Yet, they leave in the nutritional minerals that your body needs. Moreover, because they are recleanable, Black Berkey elements are more economical than the standard.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Shane O'Sullivan, who's written a book called Who Killed Bobby? And Shane is actually a television producer, video producer, film producer, who has actually put together an excellent DVD, which I just watched last night, entitled JFK Must Die, or RFK Must Die. But this book is, of course, on the murder of Bobby Kennedy. Shane, thank you so very much for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
Well, certainly, you spent an awful lot of time, actually, interviewing so many of the people who were there that night or who knew the details of what went on. And after all of your work, what is your conclusion? Do you think that Saran Saran was a lone assassin, or everything was ever done to cover up the identity of the true murderer?
Yeah, I think I feel at this stage that it boils down on the basis of the evidence to whether a jury sitting today with all the evidence we now know would convict Sirhan as the lone assassin. And I just don't think on the balance of the evidence that they would. So, you know, it's never been clear exactly who the second gunman was, but there's now, I think, fairly overwhelming evidence that there was a second gun fired in the pantry that night. And it also seems that Sirhan wasn't in full command of his faculties that night either.
And, of course, the thing is, what were the items, what were the issues that made it so very obvious that there was a second gunman there?
Well, initially, it seemed an open-and-shut case because everybody in the pantry saw Sirhan firing his gun, and they saw Kennedy fall. Kennedy was hit three times from very close range. And so it seemed at the time that it was a very simple case, but unfortunately, looking at the autopsy, the fatal shot was fired from 1 inch behind Kennedy's right ear, and the other two shots that hit Kennedy were fired from just under his armpit, again at a 1 inch or contact distance. But the main problem with that is they were fired from behind and slightly to the right of Kennedy, whereas all the witnesses placed Sirhan in front of Kennedy, and none of the witnesses placed the barrel of Sirhan's gun any closer than 1.5 to 2 feet. So we had a basic discrepancy there between what the autopsy said and where the witnesses saw Sirhan, suggesting that Sirhan did in fact fire a number of shots, but that a second gunman, perhaps standing behind and to the right of Kennedy, may have actually fired the fatal shots that hit the senator.
Well, no, wasn't there a problem that they had more bullets that were fired than there were actually bullets in Sirhan's gun?
Well, that's right. Yeah, Sirhan's gun it basically held 8 bullets, and the bullet count that night, 3 bullets hit the senator, then there were 5 other victims who were bystanders in the pantry, and then there were 4 to 5 bullet holes found in the doorways leading from the pantry back out into the stage area, and also a hinge in the doorway that led into the stage. So, you know, we're talking of up to 12, 13 possible bullets if we include those bullet holes. Unfortunately, the door frames where those bullet holes were seen by FBI agents and various police officers were then destroyed by the police before Sirhan's appeal even got off the ground. So the police, in essence, got rid of the evidence that could have told us how many bullets were fired that night.
But why would the police get rid of evidence? You would think that they would want to get the true story of who had actually killed the brother of President Kennedy.
Well, it's hard to know, you know, if they had a malicious reason for doing so, or if they just wanted to cover up, you know, a bad investigation. The crux of the ballistics and firearms evidence in this matter basically is the responsibility of one man, Dwayne Wolfer, who was the head of the police crime lab at the time. So basically he kept very few records, he destroyed a lot of the evidence, and it's very hard. He also lied on the stand.
Hold that thought, we're going to be right back.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Shane O'Sullivan, who's actually over in London right now. It must be a close to midnight there, or maybe a little after midnight. But Shane has spent a number of years actually researching the murder of Bobby Kennedy. How did you actually get started on this quest? Because you invested a large part of your life, and I'm sure a great deal of money, traveling and actually interviewing so many of the people who were there that night or knew parts of the story. How did you actually ever get into this as an you're an Irishman, aren't you?
That's right, yeah. I'm originally from Dublin, and I've been living in London for the last 12, 13 years. And, it'd be kind of surprising that as an Irishman, I didn't really know very much about Bobby Kennedy. I think he was the one of the Kennedys who never actually came to Ireland, so he's lesser known than Ted and Jack Kennedy. But I think maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I just first learned about the circumstances around his assassination and all the various theories there have been over the years that the second gunman was involved and maybe Sirhan was programmed to commit the crime and so on. And I was so fascinated by it that I started researching it. I was a screenwriter at the time and thought it would make a great script. You know, Oliver Stone had done JFK and perhaps there was a movie to be made from the RFK assassination. But the more I researched and the more I looked into, you know, what the true ending was to the story and what, you know, what problems there were with the official version, then I gradually came up with research that I felt would be better for a documentary treatment for a book treatment than fictionalizing this material. It was important that I got the facts out before attempting to fictionalize the story.
And of course, you actually talked to so many of the people who were there. The story, I thought, in fact, watching your interview with a woman who actually had seen the girl in the polka dot dress, who was actually verbally attacked by the police officer, she tells the story, how she was forced to say that she didn't see the girl in the polka dot dress, and she didn't want to say it. And you interviewed her, I guess, fairly recently.
It was a couple of years back now, just I think towards the end of 2006. But basically up until I interviewed her, she'd never been interviewed since the night of the shooting, partly out of a certain paranoia or fear for her own safety because of her treatment at the time by the LAPD. I mean, she was a 20-year-old Kennedy volunteer, had great hopes from, obviously, the trauma of seeing him shot that night, and then being basically bullied for weeks on end, day after day, by both the FBI and the LAPD to change her story. Because she was the one kind of nail that was sticking up that suggested there was a conspirator and Sirhan hadn't acted alone. And she was sticking to her story, and no matter how they tried to cajole and bully this 20-year-old girl into changing her story, she wouldn't do it. Luckily, even though the police, all of these records and the police reports were suppressed by the LAPD for 20 years, they were finally released in the late 80s. We actually had an audio recording of some of these sessions where she was bullied, which proved, you know, a factual basis that she was bullied and harangued by Hank Hernandez, who was the polygraph officer who interviewed her.
For our listeners out there who have just come back with us, Shane is talking about a woman who was there, a Mexican woman. She was actually one of the Kennedy supporters, and she was working to try to get Kennedy elected. And she was there that evening, and she saw this girl with a polka dot dress who comes running down the stairs shouting, "We killed him, we killed him." And this poor girl says, "Well, who did you kill?" They said, we killed Bobby Kennedy. And she runs off, and she's got a man with her, and who is also a Mexican-American. And of course, this young woman said, "You know, I knew knew that he was Mexican, so I'm Mexican. So I knew that. And but she told the police and the FBI, and they bullied her. They wouldn't allow her to make that statement. They attacked her. They vilified her. They intimidated her till she changed her story and finally said, "I'll say whatever you want me to say. What do you want me to say?" And then they were happy. Why would the FBI try to cover up the truth? Why would the Los Angeles Police Department, their expert who does polygraphs, try to intimidate somebody to get them to give testimony that wasn't true? That this must have been certainly a red flag for you that obviously they were covering up something.
Well, I think so. Obviously, they were under huge pressure after Dallas to come up with a clean investigation and find out who was responsible immediately. But really, Sandra Serrano wouldn't go away, and she's such a strong witness even today when I interview her, very convincing and still sticking to her story. So that's one of the key reasons why I was kind of impelled to go on this journey of a reinvestigation of the case, because I strongly felt there was more to it. I think at this stage maybe it's impossible to find the girl in polka dot dress, but Another interesting thing about Sandra Serrano was she saw the girl in polka dot dress and her accomplice run down the stairs after the shooting, but then 20 minutes before the shooting, the girl in polka dot dress and her Mexican-American colleague walked up the stairs and there was a third man with them, and Serrano at the time thought the third man looked very, very like Sirhan Sirhan himself. The suggestion that the girl in polka dot dress and her accomplice went up the stairs with Sirhan prior to the shooting, and then obviously Sirhan was apprehended and they came down the stairs just after the shooting and fled. So again, that gives a certain corroboration to her story.
But wasn't
that there was this Sirhan lookalike with them.
But wasn't there another couple that came forward and verified her story about the girl in the polka dot dress?
That's right. Well, I mean, there were several witnesses who saw a girl in a polka dot dress acting strangely or seeming elated about Kennedy being shot. And there was a Sergeant Paul Shiraga, who was one of the first LAPD officers on the scene. He interviewed an old couple called the Bernsteins in the car park, in the parking lot just below the stairs where Serrano had been sitting. And again, an older couple professed to seeing a girl in a polka dot dress fleeing, saying exactly the same wording as Serrano heard. And, you know, there was another security guard in the kitchen pantry who, again, he saw a girl in a polka dot dress making a V for victory sign over the fallen figure of Kennedy, and again smiling as she left with a couple of associates. So there was a lot of suggestions that there was a strange acting girl in polka dot dress. Everybody described the same dress, a white dress with black polka dots, and you know, her being in the pantry immediately after the shooting and then fleeing in a state of some elation.
And of course, she was a brunette, and then they interviewed a girl wearing a yellow polka dot dress who was
yes,
a blonde,
yeah.
And then they tried to convince everybody that this was the girl in the polka dot dress, and obviously everything was done to conceal the truth. And just for our listeners who just joined us, of course, there were 8 bullets in Sirhan's gun, but I don't know how many bullets were actually fired, 11, 12?
Well, the key to that is an audio recording of the shooting that's recently been found, and it's been analyzed by an audio expert called Phil Van Praagh down in Tucson, and he now testifies that there were 13 shots in the recording. So we're talking about Sirhan's gun holding 8 bullets, 13 shots existing on this audio recording of the shooting, which really only took 5 seconds. So we have 5 shots unaccounted for, which we feel probably came from a second gun, behind and to the right of Kennedy, and probably that second gun, because of the direction where it was firing from and the contact distance, probably was the gun that fired the fatal shot that killed Bobby Kennedy.
Well, I think it's so interesting that it was Thomas Noguchi, the coroner, who really did a masterful job, certainly analyzing everything there, and came to the conclusion that the gun that actually killed Bobby Kennedy was, about an inch and a half away from his head, and of course the bullet came from behind, and of course, but that information was never brought out at the trial, was it?
No, I mean the problem with the trial was that Sirhan's attorney was brought into the case very late. He basically there was very little at the time, or very very few people contesting the fact that Sirhan acted alone. Therefore, he didn't question the ballistics or firearms in the case at all. And Dr. Taniguchi, even though he testified at the trial and before the grand jury, that we have this very close contact distance and the shots from behind, the attorneys never picked up on it. And to be fair, the press didn't pick up on it either. It took a couple of years before some of the conspiracy researchers started doing work on it, like Ted Chirac, and then finally the idea of a second gun theory took hold.
And of course, that wasn't you. You even go into the background of one of the fellows who, years later, went over the ballistics on the bullet in Kennedy's head, and it didn't look like a .22. What was the story there? I mean, because Saran's gun was a .22 caliber gun, and he was shooting standing in front. But of course, the bullets that killed President Kennedy came from behind. Pardon me, I should say Bobby Kennedy came from behind. But what was this gentleman who actually analyzed the bullet fragment that came out of Bobby Kennedy's head, and what was that? What was the story there?
Well, even Dr. Noguchi, testified that he was never able to clarify the caliber of the bullet that entered Kennedy's brain, because basically it fragmented. It was a hollow point which mushroomed and fragmented and lodged in Kennedy's brain in a number of small fragments. So he was never able to say whether it was a 22 or a 38 or whatever caliber it was. And then in 1975, after a lot of pressure around this idea of a second gun, all of the key physical evidence in the case was re-examined by seven independent firearms examiners. And they concluded that there was no way that they could match any of the bullets in the case 100% to Sirhan's gun. They felt, in the case of some of the bullets, they felt it was highly probable that it was from Sirhan's gun, but they couldn't get a perfect match. They couldn't get a 100% match. And this contradicted what Dwayne Wilfer had said on the stand during the trial, that all of the bullets recovered in the pantry matched Sirhan's gun. So basically Wilfer was found to be have made false statements in court in this case.
In fact, just within the last 2 weeks here in the United States, there's a report that's come out that said so much of the forensic evidence has been used to convict people and put them in prison here in the United States and the FBI labs is all fraudulent, and that they've got. Now, suddenly, here in the year 2009, we're saying, gee, maybe we ought to have these people have some training, and maybe we ought to make sure that what they're saying is true if they're sending people to prison, because so much of the forensic evidence that people testify under oath to is simply fraudulent. Of course, in my opinion, they ought to go to prison as well when you're presenting fraudulent material and you know it's fraudulent, and tragically, this is happening in the United States. Well, so basically, of course, we have to get into the state of mind of Saran. Saran, of course, one of the interesting things you in the book, in your film, you interview his brother. And they were Christian Palestinians. They weren't Arabs at all. What's this whole idea, though, of Saran writing about in his diary about, the RFK must die, and repeating this over and over again, that was used at the trial. But does Saran really remember writing these things, and how would anybody have gotten control of Saran's mind? And because he says that he doesn't remember anything about this. So what's the real story from your point of view?
Well, yeah, Sirhan has no memory of writing in those notebooks. I mean, basically, he wanted to be a jockey, and he failed in his dream to be a jockey because he had a fall from a horse in late 66. And then he had treatment for an injured eye socket, and because he couldn't get a job, he got into hypnosis, and he would take these correspondence courses in self-hypnosis from the Rosicrucians. And around this time, this was also the time of the Arab-Israeli War, which began on June 5, 1967. And so a year, just short of a year later, Sirhan would suddenly be writing in his notebooks, after putting himself through this self-hypnosis, RFK must die, RFK must be assassinated by 5 June 68. Later, he rationalized this as Kennedy, his campaign promise to sell bombers to Israel, had somehow tapped into Sirhan's anger about the Arab-Israeli war and the Arab defeat in the Arab-Israeli war the year before. So in trying to untangle this, obviously there was a certain anger that Sirhan suddenly felt when Kennedy came out in support of the Israelis towards the close of his campaign and made a couple of speeches in synagogues promising to send bombers to Israel to drop bombs on Sirhan's Palestinian compatriots. But also the turn of events Abraham suddenly writing RFK must die in his notebook doesn't really make any sense, because Kennedy made this promise to sell bombers to Israel after Sirhan started writing RFK must die in his notebook. The first RFK must die reference came on May 18th, and the first Kennedy reference to selling the bombers to Israel came on May 26th. So there's a sense there that Sirhan and his notebook were somehow a convenient plant, so that he later became a patsy for the assassination. Obviously, the rationalization and the reason was there in terms of why he may have wanted to kill Kennedy, in terms of a conspiracy plot, but the chronology doesn't make any sense, because suddenly this anger at Kennedy, which predated any reason to be angry with Kennedy,
and I think
that's at the heart of the whole mystery of the case, I think.
And I think the most significant thing to me was the fact that he was tied into the Rosicrucians.
It is for Wild Wild, because, I mean, again, he was taking these correspondence courses in self-hypnosis, and if you're looking for, you know, a possible conspiracy plot in terms of who would he hypnotize, and it traced right back very easily to the Rosicrucians. The actual Rosicrucian membership card was found in Sirhan's wallet when he was arrested. I personally feel that, you know, this ties back into the CIA mind control programs that had been ongoing since the early 50s, where quite explicitly they stated they wanted to create a Manchurian candidate, a hypnotically programmed assassin. And this has been, you know, Congress has verified all of this during their investigations in the 70s. So I feel one of the doctors or one of the psychiatrists who was working on that program somehow recruited Sirhan and worked on him, and he was made the patsy for this assassination. He was a very vulnerable individual. He was unemployed at the time. He would go to the library or he would go to the racetrack every day. His mother would be at work, so he would be at home alone, and then he would go off to the racetrack or off to the library alone every day without very many friends, so it would be quite easy for somebody to recruit him or befriend him. And according to an expert in the field of hypnosis, Dr. Spiegel, a couple of months with the doctor seeing him every day and implanting this program or this idea that Kennedy was responsible for future deaths of Palestinians would be enough to begin to turn Sirhan and target him towards Kennedy in the roll-up to this first anniversary of the Arab-Israeli War, June 5th, 1968.
Well, now you actually, of course, talked to people who had been working with the intelligence agency, so I thought that was rather fascinating. I remember one of them in the DVD talking about how, you know, when the CIA was planning an assassination, they would always have a patsy to cover for the identity of the real assassin. That was something that we hadn't heard discussed or brought out before.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating for me because I was kind of exploring the late 60s through a generation who, you know, lived and worked at that time, both for Bobby Kennedy and also for the, you know, CIA or FBI or any of these kind of covert agencies. So it was interesting to get their take on how such an operation, if it was a conspiracy, may have been planned, what Sirhan's role might have been, you know, what other people may have been involved, and looking at it from their perspective. So that was really, really, really fascinating.
And you really have some fascinating footage there. You know, so much footage that was actually shot there, you know, at the convention that very day. Now, you talk a great deal about certain people who are there who certainly look like CIA operatives. What was the background of that?
Well, one of the key figures of interest is a guy called David Sanchez Morales, who is a legendary CIA covert operative, who was initially based out of JM Wave, which is the CIA station in Miami. And basically he was targeted towards Castro in the early 60s. The war against Castro, a possible invasion of Cuba, and some of the Castro assassination plots. So according to some of this footage that we uncovered at the Ambassador Hotel, we have a figure who looks very like David Morales and was so identified by people who had worked with him at JM Wave, who then examined this footage that I played for them during my documentary, and then they were able to identify a figure of David Morales being at the Ambassador Hotel the night Bobby Kennedy died. And it didn't surprise them. It was in keeping with his hatred of the Kennedys. He had always blamed the Kennedys for the failure of the Bay of Pigs operation. Many of the Cuban men who he had trained personally had died in that operation or been imprisoned in Cuba. And therefore, the anger at the Kennedys, Bobby Kennedy in particular.
Hold that thought, please.
young days and how Gloria wanted to stop Bobby from becoming president.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Shane O'Sullivan. We're talking about his book, Who Killed Bobby? And one of the more interesting topics in the book, and, of course, in the DVD, which he's actually produced, and we watched it last night, was the story of a man named Mr. Morales, who was, of course, been with the CIA for many years, hated the Kennedys because he felt that Jack Kennedy was responsible for the failure of the Bay of Pigs and the death of many of the men he had actually trained to go in on that that fateful day. And then, of course, at one point, you even interview a gentleman who says of Mr. Morales, well, we got rid of Jack Kennedy and we got rid of, and I've forgotten the term he used for Bobby Kennedy, but it was quite obvious that he was referring to the fact that we got rid of Bobby Kennedy. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. That was actually a good friend of David Morales, who later on did some legal work for him. And basically, he was you know, out with Morales in the early 70s, and Morales confessed to basically being in Dallas when we got the SOB and being in Los Angeles when we got the little another SOB type word. So basically, he was confessing that he was in both places for both Kennedy assassinations and was somehow involved. So we had the tape of his associates saying that. And again, that was verified by another friend of David Morales, who was in on the same kind of session in a Washington hotel in 1973. So that was really the starting point of my investigation of David Morales. And then I began to look at all the news footage taken at the Ambassador Hotel on June 4th and 5th, 1968. And then I, you know, made the connection. I saw a figure who seemed to match this very distinctive Yaqui Indian, Mexican-American man, and then I was able to verify through showing it to various associates that this was in fact David Morales at the Ambassador Hotel, the same guy who'd worked for the Kennedys in the early 60s at JM Wave.
All right, fine, because then there was a real question. There were other members of the CIA there at the Ambassador Hotel that night, isn't that correct?
Yeah, there were other figures who worked with Morales at JM Wave, who appeared to be there. There was a couple of witnesses to corroborate the figure of Gordon Campbell and George Joannides. Later, the balance turned a little bit, that we're not sure whether Campbell and Joannides were in fact there or whether they're just two men who may look like them. So I think at this stage, David Morales is the key figure of interest for me, that we obviously have his confession. He said he was in Dallas and he said he was in Los Angeles at the time of both these assassinations. So I think just the Morales alone makes it highly intriguing in terms of why he would be there.
But he told two separate people that he was involved in Bobby Kennedy's death. Isn't that correct?
That's right, yeah.
And I think it's so vitally important. Now, you'd think that this sort of information would be on the front page of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal, but of course I can assure you it's not going to be. In fact, has your book been very widely written up about or reviewed here in the United States? What came out, what about June of this year? June of last year, wasn't it?
That's right. It came out in June of last year on the 40th anniversary of the assassination. I think the problem with a lot of these books on the various assassinations is that they just get squeezed out of any media coverage. I know the same is true when William Pepper published books on the Martin Luther King case and actually worked with the King family, who believed there was a conspiracy in that case. And I know Pepper's books have never been reviewed by any of the mainstream newspapers or magazines in the U.S., you know, for obviously, you know, political or media reasons. And unfortunately, I had the same reaction with my book, but you know, the key for me is that my book acts as a kind of a blueprint for a reinvestigation or hopefully a retrial of Sirhan Sirhan. So I know William Pepper, the attorney for James Earl Ray, who with the King family established in a civil trial the innocence of James Earl Ray and the fact that there was a conspiracy in the King assassination, is now the attorney for Sirhan Sirhan, and I've been working quite closely with him, and I hope my book will be, you know, of great use to him in hoping to reopen the investigation and getting a trial for Sirhan. And I know Sirhan Sirhan in prison in California. He also has a copy of my book, and I think, you know, he's found it very, very useful in trying to piece together what happened. Because, you know, his line down the years has always been that people like myself know more about the shooting than he does, because he can't remember any of the facts of the case, and he just doesn't remember the key moments of that night, and is as baffled as everybody else.
And of course, we actually have interviewed Mr. Pepper on several occasions on his book, An Act of State, going into the background of the government assassination of Martin Luther King. We have a four-tape set on that. And but I will say one thing. I do a lot of radio interviews, and very often books like yours are actively suppressed by the publicist, but your publicist, to her credit, has really done everything she could to help me get in touch with you and arrange this interview. So at least you're not being sabotaged by your own publisher, as really does actually happen.
Even one of the key books on the early 70s was brought out by Random House, and they quickly burned nearly all the copies, sent them to the incinerator because they didn't want the story to get out. So luckily I've had a great relationship with my publisher, Union Square Press, and they've done a really great job. But it's an uphill struggle to get past the major media.
Would you mind mentioning what was that book that was actually, that you know of, that was suppressed before? Because I've run into some, but which book were you thinking of?
Yeah, it was actually called The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy by Turner and Christian, by Bill Turner and John Christian. They were the co-authors, and this was brought out by Random House in 1978. But I know that shortly after publication, most of the print run was sent to the incinerator, after some threat from a mob figure that had been mentioned in the book itself. So yeah, I mean, I think Bill Turner was actually an ex-FBI agent. He wrote for Ramparts magazine back in the late 60s, and he's written a number of really great books, either on, you know, the rise in America and their influence in terms of Power on the Right, I think was one of his books, and he's also written on a number of other assassination-related things, and I know he enjoyed my book, so yeah, I mean, it's good to keep the story going.
No, because I have no other books. Kiss the Boys Goodbye by Monica Jensen Stevens, and she personally told me that they'd accidentally shredded 5,000 copies of her books, just accidentally, you know. I don't know, somebody must have pushed the wrong button, but anyway. What about your DVD? Is that available here in the United States?
It is, yeah. The DVD is, I think, widely available now on Amazon or, you know, just the normal sites. So it came out on DVD, and it also had a short run in the movie theater in New York. It came out here in the UK, and it's just coming out on DVD in Australia. So yeah, I mean, that's been a good way of publicizing the case as well. And when it came out in the movie theaters in New York in June, I also did a 7-minute update around this new audio evidence, which seems to indicate that 13 shots were fired in the pantry. So you can now see that on my website, rfkmustdie.com, and it's a good way of just keeping this very important case in the public eye. I mean, obviously, there's great hope now with Obama becoming president, but it echoes what happened with the 60s, or what could have happened in the 60s if Bobby Kennedy had been elected. So I hope we don't forget him, and we don't forget trying to pursue justice in this case.
Well, basically, we might be interested in carrying the DVD. Who would we go to get them wholesale? Do you have any idea?
Oh, I can pass those details to you. Yeah, I mean, it's actually distributed by Document Films. They're based out of Chicago, but I can email you the contacts there.
I would really appreciate that. We're going to be back here in just a moment when we bring all of our stations back on board here, right here at Genesis Network. And of course, we're talking with Shane O'Sullivan on the subject, Who Killed Bobby? Dr. Stan, I guess Shane O'Sullivan, the book Who Killed Bobby, and I think we're going to carry this book. It's an excellent book, and we probably will hope that we can go ahead and carry the DVD as well. Now, do you have a website or anything you'd like to get out about your
website? Yeah, I have two websites, actually. One is for the movie RFK Must Die, so that's rfkmustdie.com. And then for the book is called Who Killed Bobby, and that's whokilledbobby.net.
It's really a very, very readable book. In fact, the detail is amazing because basically Shane has talked to so many of the people who were actually there that night or know what happened or even know, of course, the CIA methods of assassination. He actually talks to one gentleman there who's really quite open. He won't tell everything. It's obviously he has to keep certain things back because he obviously would be endangering his own life if he were to say too much. But he talked an awful lot about the techniques of CIA assassinations and how they ordinarily would have a patsy, and then they would have the real shooter. And, of course, all the attention is focused on the patsy while the real shooter does the job and he gets away scot-free. And that was, of course, what happened with Lee Harvey Oswald. And the technique has been used over and over again. But although the gentleman you mentioned, I don't think mentioned Oswald. He certainly described very well the sort of setup that they would use to distract people's attention so they really wouldn't see what happened. I thought that was a fascinating part of the interview.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was David Rayburn that I interviewed in Phoenix. Yeah, and I mean, he basically worked as a freelance operator for an awful lot of agencies. And, you know, just talking to him, he would say that there's kind of an alternative history that the public don't know. Obviously, there's one story that's put in the public eye for public consumption, but then the actual story of what really happened is just kept very close between the various operatives who work on the operation and who on a need-to-know basis just know something about one operation but don't know anything but suspect a lot about other operations. So, you know, he said that the hairs on the back of your neck would stand on end if you knew what really happened in a lot of our contemporary history.
Yeah, well, I think that's really so true. Basically, of course, as you get into the background of Saran, and the fact that he, for some reason, his mind certainly has either suppressed or he really doesn't remember what happens. And of course, he's coming up on parole every couple of years, and the reason he hasn't been granted a parole is because he is not, of course, he is not remorseful for what happened, and yet how can he be remorseful if he doesn't even remember what happened? And so it's sort of circular logic why we can't get him out of prison. But certainly, have you ever talked to Saran or interviewed him?
No, the unfortunate thing is that in California you can't actually interview the inmates on camera or using any sound equipment. And it's a bit tricky at the moment because he's been held in very difficult conditions in Corcoran Prison in California. It was hard for a while for even his brother to get in to see him. So I haven't met him in person, but I've corresponded with him I write him a letter and then he writes a letter to his brother and his brother reads it to me over the phone. So we've kind of got this circular chain of communication going. But I think he's been extraordinarily patient over 40 years, given the fact that he can't remember anything about the shooting, just trying to help researchers like myself, trying to get to the bottom of the case. And the fact is that he's been eligible for parole since the early 80s, and, you know, obviously because of the political climate since then, and certainly the political climate after 9/11, there seems little hope for the foreseeable future that he will be released. I think in terms of his mind, I mean, you don't just have to take my word for it. All the psychiatrists who have examined him over the years have come to the conclusion that he's telling the truth when he says he doesn't remember. And they felt that there were compelling reasons for that and that, you know, programming was a quite likely reason for him not remembering. I think this psychiatrist, Dr. Bernard Diamond, who actually was working on the defense team, felt that Sirhan had programmed himself through these self-hypnosis sessions, but then other psychiatrists feel that the programming was done by another. And if the programming was done by a third person, I feel it has to lead back to the intelligence agencies who were doing all the pioneering work in this field since the early 50s.
Now, in your research, did you get at all into the relationship between the Central Intelligence Agency and the occult? And, of course, the Rosicrucians are part of this world occult movement, a very important one. They've been around since the 1400s. They've tapped into the secret knowledge, and of course, this is what they teach, is the ancient religion of Gnosticism and the worship of a different god. But did you get at all into the relationship between the CIA and these occult organizations?
Not as much as I would have liked. I mean, there are It's curious because obviously he had his Rosicrucian membership card. He's also into the Rosicrucians and the Theosophical Society. He visited Manly Palmer Hall, who was a very famous master hypnotist who was based in California at the time. But then it's very blatant, you know. He had the membership card. The police would obviously go straight to the Rosicrucians. So, you know, trying to tease out the link between the Rosicrucians and the intelligence agencies is quite a tricky thing to do after that. I also think when I came along, which was just a couple of years ago, a lot of the doctors who had actually worked on the CIA mind control operations had actually passed away at that point. A lot of them died in the kind of mid to late 90s. So it was a shame I couldn't interview some of those. But my basically authority on hypnosis would be Dr. Herbert Spiegel, who's been an expert in it for 50 years at Columbia University. And he strongly believes that Sirhan was programmed by another person. He believes it wouldn't be that difficult to do with the right subject. And Sirhan certainly was the right subject. He was highly hypnotizable. Of the, you know, one of the 5 to 10% of the population who it's possible to make do something against their will in this way.
Well, it's really a fascinating thing to contemplate. And of course, Manly P. Hall didn't die until, I think, about 1990, 1991. Of course, Bobby Kennedy was executed. I thought it was fascinating, just 8 weeks after Martin Luther King was executed, why Bobby Kennedy was executed. And of course, I can remember the terrible feeling of, you know, almost despair or hopelessness as we saw all of these things happen. Each one of them had a profound effect on the minds of the American people. And I'm old enough to remember, of course, the series of events with the murder of Jack Kennedy, and then, of course, a few years later, of Martin Luther King, and then, of course, his brother, Jack Kennedy's brother, is killed. Well, certainly, there is an effort to try to get a retrial, or what would be the effort as far as Sirhan is concerned, because certainly if there was a second gun, why, of course, there's no way from the evidence that was there that the pathologist came up with, Thomas DiGucci, and the other things, that Sirhan's gun killed Bobby Kennedy. Certainly he shot other people. He did something, but nobody ever wants to ask why he really did it.
Yeah, well, I think there's kind of a twin-track strategy going on at the moment. Paul Schrade, who was a very good friend of Bobby Kennedy and who was actually shot in the head that night, is leading the campaign from Los Angeles to get a reinvestigation of the firearms in the case based around this new audio recording illustrating that 13 shots were fired. So he's lobbying the LAPD and the LA District Attorney's Office, LA County District Attorney's Office, to open the case in that regard. And then William Pepper is working on behalf of Sirhan to establish that his mental state indicates that he wasn't in control of his actions that night and therefore can't be held to the first-degree murder charge that he was convicted of back in 1969. Obviously, you put the two of those together, a second gun and 13 shots, and Sirhan not being in his correct mental state at the time of the shooting, and that would obviously give better grounds for Sirhan earning parole and hopefully earn a reinvestigation of the case and perhaps a retrial for Sirhan. You know, even going back to the original trial, he was given first-degree murder and he was given the death sentence that was later commuted to life after California repealed the death penalty laws in 72. But if he'd been given second-degree murder or even manslaughter, and, you know, that was being contemplated by the defense and the prosecution at one point, he would have been out of jail in the early to mid 80s. So there's a sense that, you know, he wasn't in control of his actions that night. He didn't kill Bobby Kennedy anyway because the second gun actually fired the fatal shot. Therefore, you know, 40 years is an awful long sentence for a man who didn't actually commit the assassination of Bobby Kennedy.
And, of course, the interesting thing is, as you've gone over the handling of the evidence, you know, and certainly so much of the police work, it seems incredible that, you know, a modern police force could have done such a poor job unintentionally. Did you have a feeling, or at least the possibility enter your mind as you were going over all the evidence, that somebody in the police force was trying to have only one assassination, no question at all, this is it, it's cut and dried, and we're not going to look any further, we're not going to look for the possibility that somebody else killed Bobby Kennedy?
Well, I think institutionally they were given great pressure from on high, you know, to close down the case and just come up with a lone gunman solution, if you like. So they certainly, that was the line they pursued very stubbornly and to Sandra Serrano's cost. So I feel there were key players, you know, in terms of Enrique Hank Hernandez, who's the polygraph operator, who got rid of all the conspiracy witnesses, Dwayne Wolfer, who looked at the firearms evidence. Really, just two or three key people in charge of key areas of the case were able to shut it down. And because we weren't able to read the police records or the official police report for 20 years, there was no way that the public could know what was going on and how shoddy the investigation was. And it was only through the dogged work of certain researchers back in the 70s that any of this came to light at all. So I think, you know, that's one reason why it took a long time for people to really wake up to the possibility of a second gunman in this case. And the problem was that when the public did wake up and were made aware of the problems in the case, a lot of the key evidence had been destroyed by the police already, which has made it very difficult to get the case fully reopened after that.
Well, I was always fascinated with the fact that Thomas Noguchi, coroner down there in Los Angeles, had actually done simulated tests to demonstrate, because of the pattern of gunpowder on Bobby Kennedy's head, that the gun was only an inch and a half away from him. That was really masterful work, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody who attended the autopsy or who looked at Noguchi's work afterwards, it claims that it's one of the most complete and thorough autopsies ever done, you know, and he's always been very independent in terms of stating his conclusions as scientific facts and letting, you know, the police try and match it to the witness statements or make sense of it. So he's always supported reopening the case if he felt there was a need to do so. And I know when his book, Autobiography, was published in the early 80s, he quite clearly stated that he's never said conclusively that Sirhan alone was the killer of Bobby Kennedy. It's always felt inconclusive to him in terms of what really happened because of the lack of scientific certainty in terms of who the players in the assassination were. I think we've moved on a step from that now because of this new audio recording, which seems to indicate, allied to Noguchi's autopsy, that 13 shots were fired. So it is very frustrating that the authorities won't wake up to this and grant us the reinvestigation that should proceed from now.
Well, I thought it was very interesting you brought out the fact in your book that people that said that Bobby Kennedy, aren't you worried about being assassinated? And he really realized that he might very well be killed, but he was doing what he thought was really the right thing to do.
Yeah, and that was very much his attitude. It was almost a very stoic or romantic attitude, in a way that he was going to, he knew perhaps there were guns between him and the White House, but, you know, the country needed him at that time. The country needed him to take on this kind of epic journey to try and get there and try and make it, despite all the dangers. And he just bowled right into it. You know, a million people would turn out in the streets and grab his cufflinks and grab his shoes and tear him limb from his car in the sheer joy to see him. But he was willing to leave himself open and you know, kind of irresponsibly open in a way to gunfire by not having the police around and not having bodyguards with guns around and just throwing himself at the people and hoping they would carry him to the White House and he wouldn't be killed on the way. But unfortunately, he didn't quite make it.
Well, the thing is, I think he probably would have become the president. Certainly, he was a much more colorful character than Hubert Humphrey was that year.
Yeah.
And, of course, Lyndon Johnson had bowed out. Of course, he was a very wicked, evil man, as far as I'm concerned. But certainly, it would appear that there are people in Washington, D.C. who did not want Bobby Kennedy to be the president. After all, he would have probably reopened the investigation of his brother's murder, don't you think?
Well, yeah, he'd publicly come into it. He'd talk publicly about that and also in private that, you know, he would wait until he got the White House to reopen the investigation into his brother's death. Obviously, he was going to pull out of Vietnam, withdraw slowly from Vietnam, cut down on the defense spending, and probably destroy the careers of Hoover and Helms in the FBI and CIA, respectively. So I think a lot of the Washington elite or the Washington establishment had an awful lot to lose had Bobby Kennedy gained the White House. And they knew from the previous administration, the previous Kennedy administration, that Bobby Kennedy was the one guy you couldn't really control when he got into the White House. He would pretty much run his own agenda, and he wasn't open to political lobbying and, you know, arm twisting. So once he got in the White House, he would be very hard to stop. So somehow they had to get him before he got there.
And I really think that is exactly what happened, because as you read this book, and I've actually interviewed the gentleman who wrote the book about the 14 bullets, and I've interviewed the fellow who actually heard the tapes and documented the fact that there were 14 bullets fired. And I don't care what you say, there's just no way you can fire 14 bullets from a pistol that only has 8 bullets in it, especially when you've got Rosie Grier leaning on you and doing everything they can to prevent you from firing the gun, or certainly not reloading it. What about the fact that you talk about Rosie Grier and the other fellow who was with him, who's a decathlon winner, and they were talking about Saran's superhuman strength. That was a very interesting thing. That, hey, here, anybody's ever seen a picture of Rosie Grier, you'd think he could hold anybody down, but they were having a terrible time, weren't they?
That's right. There were six or seven of them struggling with Saran. And I mean, Saran was 5'2", 5'3", just a very short, wiry, as I say, he tried to be a jockey. You would think he wouldn't have that much strength, but they talked of superhuman strength as he gripped that gun and they couldn't wrest it from his hands, and he kept firing as they were struggling with him on the steam table. Another witness described Sirhan as glassy-eyed. He just incredibly tranquilized, again suggesting that he wasn't quite in his right mental state at the time, but also had this immense strength, which suggests hypnosis, suggests drugs, suggests some sort of altered state that, again, plays into this idea of him being there with others involved.
Some altered state of consciousness. We're going to be back in just a minute. We've got a few moments more. Please hang on. But our guest has been Shane O'Sullivan. His book, Who Killed Bobby? If you want to order it, we'll be ordering it and having it available. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest has been Shane O'Sullivan, and we've got 3 minutes before I have to let you go. Must be getting pretty late over there for you.
Yeah, it's about 10 to 1 here. So.
All right, fine. Well, we get
we just got
three more minutes for what thoughts would you like to leave with our listeners all across America after spending a number of years of your own time, and it must have been a very expensive issue to go around and take video pictures of all of these people, and the interviews are really fascinating. I think you've done a great job on that DVD, but what's your final conclusion after all of this?
Well, I think I still feel the passion of the people who remember 68 and how important it was and how the country changed because of this event. So I think in terms of contemporary history for the U.S., it's very important that after all these years, we actually find out what happened. And as the witnesses are dying out, this perhaps is the last chance to do so. So we now have this hard scientific evidence of the audio recording of these gunshots. So I would just ask people to spread the word and build awareness of the case and put the media and public awareness of the case back in the spotlight so at last we can get it reopened. And my work and the work of others, will lead somewhere, because we still have a guy in prison who's been there for 40 years, and I think he's never had a fair trial. So we owe him that, and we owe Bobby Kennedy and his memory and his legacy, an effort to get to know the truth before all of those who can help us find out the truth pass away, and history will, be incorrect if we leave it that way.
And of course, one of the things that one of the people you talked to was talking about and stressing the importance of finding out the truth. You have an excellent interview there with a gentleman who was on the House Select Committee that investigated the murder of John Kennedy. And of course, they came out with an entirely different conclusion, the Warren Commission. And
yeah.
I think that's a fascinating bit of film footage right there. But the similarities are so similar, you know, the number of shots that were fired, and certainly there were not just three shots fired at JFK, there were more shots than they. The audio tapes reveal that, and they reveal the same thing with the murder of Bobby Kennedy. Well, I want to thank you very much for staying up with us, and if you could, of course, email me the information on the where we can get those DVDs so we can
get
the whole thing.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
We'd love to carry them. I want to thank you for all the hard work you've done, and I think it's vitally important that we get the information out while we still can. God bless. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thanks so much for your help.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, fine. Well, I hope our listeners have enjoyed our interview with Shane O'Sullivan and his book, Who Killed Bobby? And ladies and gentlemen, they've lied to us for many years, and there was a conspiracy. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope that you enjoyed our interview with Shane O'Sullivan. I certainly learned something unique here tonight, and it was not only I knew that that of course that Bobby had been associated with the occult. Saran Saran had been associated with the occult and the Rosicrucians. I did not know he had been actually gone to visit Y. Manly P. Hall. And you must understand that there are elements within the government that are involved in the occult, and there are divisions within the military, I suspect within the CIA as well, that are tapped into the supernatural. And when you begin to understand that, you would understand how they would be able to control Bobby Saran Saran's mind, and perhaps even get him to write, you know, in his journal, RFK must die. RFK must die. So understand that nothing as it appears to be, unless you understand we're involved in a supernatural battle being fought for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. If you've not yet seen the new DVD, The Eye of the Phoenix, going into the occult emblems on the back of the dollar bill that you see every day, well, you need to get that. It's available from Radio Liberty. We carry Manly P. Hall's book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages, where he tells you how they hide their emblems in plain sight. You see them every day. You don't recognize them because you're not supposed to, and nobody's going to dare tell you about them. And then, of course, we carry a wonderful book by Kathy Burns, Dr. Kathy Burns, entitled, Secret Freemasonic and Occult Symbols. Freemasonic and Occult Symbols. We recommend all of these items, and certainly we have so much information on mind control, and Operation Monarch goes into the CIA. It's an excellent DVD, that's Operation Monarch. So get the information and help us to get it out across America. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is radioliberty.com. And if you haven't yet gotten your long-term storage food in, and if you'd like to get a catalog, a Ready Reserve catalog, Ready Reserve food catalog, give us a call. We'll send it to you. Then, of course, we do hope that if you want to get information on the Berkey water filter, so that you really need some means of purifying your water if there's a problem, and certainly the Berkeys are an inexpensive way to do it, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And you should have a supply of health products on hand, but you have to understand that behind everything going on are powerful spiritual forces. And let me suggest Pastor Billy Crone's 10-DVD series, The Final Countdown. That's The Final Countdown. We also, of course, have his 10-DVD series on creation and his 4-DVD series on RFID identification, the mark that they want, the implant that they want in every human being and every animal and every item in the world. Why would they want that? Because they want to track you. To the point where one day you'll not buy or sell, unless, of course, you have the identification. Whether it'll be an RFID chip or a Vera chip or something else, we don't know. But we do know that the powerful spiritual forces are there, and they're working at the highest levels of our government at every level, and behind them are organizations like the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Bilderbergers. And if you want to see how they're responsible for what's going on as far as our economic system is concerned, you'll certainly want to get our newsletters, our November and December 2008 letters. Our January 2009 letter will be going out very, very soon, and it will take you into the people who are really responsible for destroying our economy and their plan to impoverish our people. You need to get the information. You need to help get others to get it. We've got the great new book, of course, The Money Creators. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And remember our website, it's RadioLiberty.com, where you can read our letters, they're gratis. You can watch our DVDs, watch our YouTube uplinks, so you can listen to our programs. The information's there. Please access it. Encourage others to do it as well. Until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord.